Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of The BIP Show is brought to you by OpenTrader. OpenTrader is Australia's most competitive, self-directed retail trading platform for professional traders and those who want to invest like a pro from only $5 per trade. It provides chess-sponsored trading accounts and award-winning charts, combined with ongoing educational support and training. You'll get full autonomy on how you select stock and detailed info on performance across multiple metrics to help you make robust decisions. OpenTrader. Invest like a pro from only $5 per trade.
How are you now? You're listening to The BIP Show. BIP is for business, investing and policy. That is what we're here to talk about. I am James Whelan, investment manager at VFS Group, and I'm not here, as always, unfortunately, with Paul Colgan, director at CT Group. But Paul is in a different part of Sydney. We're in lockdown version 2, version 3.0 for myself, but version 2 for a lot of people. And in Amsterdam, Ken Vexler, director at Acumen Management. Now, we're recording this on Monday, June the 28th, my goodness, 2021. Please do not forget to hit subscribe and rate us wherever you get your podcasts. Give us those 5-star ratings, please. Go through. It doesn't take long. It really does help us out when that happens. Tell your friends and put some good stuff on social media. We've got some good things coming on the webpage and on the Facebook page as well you want to know about. Well, here we are, lockdown version, like I said, lockdown version 3.0 for myself, version 2.0 for a lot of people. Ken, it seems like most of the time when I've talked to Ken over the last year, he's been in some sort of a lockdown or another. We're going to find out how that's all cooking over there. Colgo, mate, the BIP Show was born in lockdown. It's part of the reason why the three of us decided to start this nonsense and for what it's become now. And I sort of feel almost a little bit more comfortable in this scenario of doing it, of being locked inside my own house effectively and out of microphone, not being able to see anyone.
Yeah, it's like mate, going home.
How are you battling through it, mate? And how do you see with a finger on the pulse of the rest of Australia, as I assume you do? How do you see this affecting the rest of Australia?
Yeah, look, this one is a bit harder to take, I think. Just speaking personally, it's probably to do with having had the taste of freedom for so long, and frankly enjoying it. Going back to, so yeah, it's like, when you go snowboarding, I'm just going to use a snowboarding, so skiing analogy. You get back on the slopes, and for the first little bit, you've no idea what you're doing, and then slowly it comes back. So the whole working from home thing, like, how do you do a lockdown? Like, how do you cope with it? Like, the whole idea of being cooped up in the house for weeks on end, so just relearning all that stuff about how to work from home, how to do those meetings properly, how to schedule your day, how to not go bananas, just relearning all of that stuff. Been actually good talking to friends and colleagues in Melbourne who obviously have vastly more experience with this because they've had such a tough time with it. But they've had lots of useful bits of useful advice, including one person who said, do this, do that, do that. And then the other thing is drink. I'm like, sure.
The collectively kissing goodbye of dry July was, you can sort of hear the big sigh of relief.
Yeah.
Everyone realized they
didn't
have to commit to this nonsense.
Yeah, oh no, dry July is over. Oh well. More broadly, we kind of know how these things roll now. There is a big difference this time around with this lockdown in that there isn't a JobKeeper in place. there's going to be government support for businesses, federal and state government payments in the works, but nothing of the scale of JobKeeper. And of course, the sheer amount of time that was involved in previous lockdowns, fingers crossed, tapping every bit of wood that I can find here in my attic, which is actually the best place to record up here because it's nicely soundproofed. So, hopefully this will be shortish, this lockdown. Numbers were good today, Monday. And the bounce back effect that we got from previous lockdowns was partially thanks to pent up demand in the form of accumulated savings that people had that they were ready to go and spend because they couldn't spend it before, right? So the impact of that might be minimized, but in the broad sense, the Australian economy is still doing extremely, extremely well. Unemployment rate came down from 5.5 to 5.1 in the last jobs numbers. There was, you know, nearly 100,000 jobs created, just from memory. These are big numbers. These are the signs of a roaring economy, you know. The underemployment rate was down, you know. The number of people in jobs is 13.1 million, you know, and like it's strong. So there's a lot to be bullish about, even though might be pretty personally myself in a pretty dark place at the moment.
Everyone says there's always someone who's in a worse place than you, and think about that. So speaking of which, Ken, how's it?
Well, you know, isn't that one of life's little ironies, in that I think, what was it, as of Saturday, so just a couple of days ago, pretty much the bulk of all lockdown measures and sort of, you know, regulatory framework in terms of keeping everyone safe and locked up, it's all been pretty much lifted here. Now, sure. Do I personally think that's a little premature and a little, you know, ahead of its time? Yeah, but then again, I'm not, you know, the health minister nor the prime minister here. Things would be awfully different had I been one of those. So basically, vaccination numbers here have really picked up with significant pace. I'm not sure of the exact numbers, but something like, I think conservatively speaking, I think maybe close to 60% of the population's probably had about its first jab, or 60% of the eligible population, maybe about 25 to 30 are fully vaxxed. Masks are no longer mandatory anywhere other than public transport. Still keep 1.5 meters distance, wash your hands, do all that sort of stuff. But life, for what it seems, I mean, whatever normal in this day and age can be considered, seems to be slowly creeping back. But look, let's put things in perspective. Like, I mean, I appreciate things aren't fantastic in Australia, and certainly hotspots here and there. But, you know, to put it in relative terms, we still have, even today, nationwide here, probably in the vicinity of about 600 new cases every day.
Wow.
So that, you know, I mean, considering what it was, which used to be north of about 9 or even 10,000 cases a day, is pretty good news. But, you know, 800 here or 600 here versus, you know, whatever you guys have in Oz at the moment, sort of may put things in perspective. But again, sitting from a distance, it also highlights, at least in the Australian instance, you know, dare I say it, the ineptitude of the federal government. I mean, you know, I remember speaking way back when, probably, I don't know, March this year, to you guys about vaccination rollout in Australia and the fact that, you know, what's the rush? There's no whatever. And yeah, in March, fine. What's the rush? But we're now nearly, you know, 1 July, and having read, you know, what the numbers are like in terms of vaccinations in Oz, that's pretty sketchy. Like, you know, and what I've come to understand is that, you know, it's a federally mandated policy with a state government level plan for distribution. So it's not even necessarily on the state governments. It's a federal issue but to be administered by states based on the federal guidelines. And if the federal guidelines are clearly, well, politely put, lacking,
yeah,
then, you know, there's only so much blowback you can put on state premiers and the like.
Yeah. I think that we did come to the conclusion that it is, in fact, a race, regardless of what someone may have said that it wasn't a race, that it is in fact, a race. And based on what I saw at Homebush yesterday, when I went to get my jab yesterday, and I'm actually originally booked for a couple of weeks away. I went to the website again, hit the refresh button, and I have joked that it's just like getting semi-final tickets. You know, you've got to go to a couple of different websites, a couple of different sites, get some tips from friends, hit the refresh button. Okay, yep, there's some seats have opened up, I've got to get to it, and then you still got to travel out to Homebush and still walk away with a bit of pain. It did have a bit of a semi-final feeling out at Homebush yesterday. That a great few thousand people, I've got to say, at least 10,000 people that I saw over the course of the 3 hours when I was out there, at least. So they've opened the floodgates on the vaccination rollout. Now this lockdown, looking at a Morgan Stanley note just here, the lockdown, the direct economic impact of the current lockdown measures at about Australian dollars 2 billion. Which is about 0.1% of annual GDP. So that's a real number. That is now, obviously, because it's the Delta variant, they're saying that it's a bigger risk for, you know, something a bit more detrimental. They do mention the fact that there is less stimulus support coming through, and that there is limited, and this is the kicker, there's limited vaccine upside. So you guys want to have a guess of what's our one dose percentage for Australia at the moment?
What, those that have had already the first dose?
Yep.
Mate, I make you 3-4% as a spread.
Probably, well, we're 25 okay, have had at least one dose, and only 5% have had two doses. So
okay,
it's. I think that one dose is sort of everyone that I asked, they were also low bidders too, Ken. So it seems like the perception is that we're further behind than we are. We need frontline workers, and we need people that are in hot spots that are potential spreaders to be shifting that around.
We need everybody to be vaccinated.
Everybody
should just get vaccinated, and like particularly like the vulnerable, but like just everybody get vaccinated, and then we can get on with life.
That is true. We won't have to go through this bizarre ritual again.
Just to interject, I think we can probably circle back to the notion of it being a race. I suppose when we, for, you know, later in the show, talk about probably the global perspective or what's happening around the world, I think that's something that very many people are very keen and quick to discount, the fact that it's not a race, because obviously numbers globally are, in terms of vaccination and whatever else, are going fairly well and fairly quickly. But I think too many people are too quick to dismiss the idea that it's no longer a race, and it is a race between, in my mind at least, the Delta variant and its spread globally versus exactly that, the ability to have critical masses of populations properly vaccinated.
Well, there's a fantastic little case study here in Sydney. There was a party
yes,
where there was, I think, 28 people, 22.
Yeah, there's 30. Round it up.
30 people. Six people didn't catch it.
Yeah.
And they were the
six. What was their common factor?
The thing they all had in common, they were all vaccinated.
That's right.
The other 22 caught it.
And
easy. Then there's one over. Yeah. So it works.
It does work. That is true.
So it works not just in terms of stopping you from getting sick, which is what it's designed to do, but it also, in that case, stopped all six of those people getting it.
Now, more importantly, I did think that we were all going to be able to move from being epidemiologists and immunologists and any other sort of ologists to also still carry in our jobs in finance, but it looks like they dragged us back in to do this one more round. Now, let's talk about some stuff that we are supposed to know about and is still honestly confusing the hell out of me. On this one, there's no vaccine for the amount of Fed speakers that we saw last week, 16 in total. Powell, I think it was at the latter end of the week before last, Powell with his comments about the way that they were planning on seeing inflation off or when they were moving interest rates, and also the dot plot also adding to more of this, the craziness. Now, I need someone, if only I knew someone who was adept at cutting through the BS and could actually explain what the hell was going on. Maybe someone potentially with a good experience in finance, maybe with, you know, this sorts of rates knowledge potentially. Do you know anyone, Ken, who might be able to help us cut through the BS and tell us what the hell's going on with the yield curve, or tell us what's going on with rates?
Can I find a friend?
Or yeah,
in the absence of that, I suppose I'll give it a nudge, although I'd be hard-pressed to believe that I've got any real insight. Look, I think let's wind it back a little bit. We had the Fed, the FOMC, a couple of weeks ago, obviously with the revised dot plot, and that's where the proverbial hit the fan as far as the rates market and the yield curve. I mean, we saw the long end get bit up significantly in that yield on the 30-year. Well, without being too, you know, hyperbolic about it, it did really move, like significantly so, that the yield came off massively. We had a flattener in that case. The belly also came off, although probably not as dramatically. And it's all because there was sort of an affirmation in that dot plot of when the Fed perceives the first rate hike to be coming, and you know, confirming. And this is the odd bit. It sort of pretty much confirmed what everyone had already assumed, in that the hike wouldn't be before sort of end of 23 or thereabouts. And yet we saw this reaction in the curve. And to me, honestly, it spoke of nothing more. And maybe this is far too simplistic, but then again, I'm not exactly a complex human. It spoke of nothing more than a positional washout, in that everyone had been so geared up for this, had positioned for it accordingly, and realized that there was probably no more, or in fact, there was no more juice in that particular trade. And it was just a case of getting out of that position and out of that trade before the next bloke. And so that sort of, you know, created the momentum that really exaggerated, I think, the move that we saw. Since then, you know, the belly settled down and we're sort of back to ish around where we were prior to that Fed meeting. The back end, the 30 years, probably recovered, maybe not as well, but it's on its way. And so we're back to sort of where we were. And to me, before we get into what the Fed speakers did or didn't say subsequent to the meeting, to me that speaks of the curve where it is being fair enough. You know, it's representative of where things should be, and maybe the market finally actually taking note of what the Fed is genuinely saying and its new framework. And what it's saying and has been saying for God knows how long is that their average inflation targeting, which means that they'll run it hot. How long they let it run it hot for remains to be seen. But, you know, the law of mathematics says an average means you've got to print over, not just under, to achieve that average. So, and we are also subsequently seeing inflation prints coming off the initial, you know, stellar high prints that were very much expected, because, I mean, you had base effects, you had reopenings in the States and the like. So obviously that was going to lead to higher inflation prints. I'm not going to get into the whole argument or conversation about whether it's transient, transitory, what it means and the like. I think what we are generally going to be experiencing is a curve not dissimilar to where it is now. There'll be fluctuations here and there based on various data points and prints, various bits of rhetoric out of the various Fed speakers. But on the whole, I think the US economy is sort of, you know, trudging along as it should be. I think the key point to understand, at least from my perspective, is the following, that I still believe that inflation as we understand it, or higher inflation as we understand it, will be and is transitory. I think the only caveat to that is that the various prints giving us an understanding that, you know, oh my God, there's inflation, I think those prints are generally going to be and have been higher than many expected, therefore adding sort of fuel to the fire of, my God, inflation's here and it's going to be huge. So there's that to consider. Those prints, while they may be brief, are going to be higher than most expected. And the other thing is, I think a lot of people, at least, you know, my perception at least, and certainly on, you know, via various media channels and whatever else, there's a lot of well, here's inflation today. Oh my God, it's gone tomorrow. And a lot of it is based purely on where the curve is and how the curve has moved, right? So when the curve sold off, or rather got bit up, and 10 years sold off, you know, the yields came off and the 30 years came off, everyone's like, oh, okay, well, no inflation all of a sudden. They're not going to hike rates, this, that, and the other. Just wait till, you know, the 10 years back at 160 if and when, and we'll have that conversation again about, my God, we've got inflation and it's not transitory. People just seem to have goldfish-like memories at the moment.
And, it did seem that way, didn't it?
And they're just reactive, not so much objectively by taking a step back and having a think about what's actually happening, but they're looking at what price is doing, what the curve is doing, and sort of inferring their view on the back of that, which is sort of not only counterintuitive, it's actually it's backward in to my mind. So, look, in a nutshell, I think, you know, that's my view on where we are. Globally, inflation, that's a different story, because you've got various central banks, and certainly in the EM space, already raising rates. You've got talk of various other banks tapering. I mean, you had, you know, Bank of Canada essentially begin its tapering. There's talk of the RBA. Oh, frankly, who cares what the RBA is doing? But
I was, you know, about to ask that. We've had a question about the RBA, so yeah, we'll get back to that in a sec.
Yeah. Well, I mean, while we're there, I mean, the RBA, look, they've committed to keeping rates where they are till whatever it is, mid-23 or thereabouts. They've also committed, at least rhetorically, to adjusting post that if and when. I still believe, you know, whether they like to admit it or not, that they are going to persist in, you know, essentially yield curve control and targeting. The ammunition that they expend on that may change, but and may be reduced somewhat, but I think, you know, the commitment's there. And anything and everything can happen between now and then. So, you know, even if they do sort of talk further about maybe talking about considering, you know, raising rates, yeah, or whatever, look, you know, we're 2 years away, you know, and a lot can happen. And that's sort of, you know, again, we'll get back to this maybe later in the show, but it sort of resonates with my perception at the beginning of the year of what everyone was talking about, you know, this being the golden age of, you know, a return to the roaring 20s and whatever else, where my perception was, I'm not refuting that, but I do think it's going to be stops and starts and fits and spatters rather than globally away we go and it's all green shoots and watch out, here we come. And I think we're sort of starting to experience that, although maybe not in the same I suppose way that I had maybe initially perceived it, but I think we're having that.
Yeah, no, that's good. There is a trade there. Now, the question that's come in from Tim Kelly and also from Marco Abbott was just whether the lockdown was going to change what the RBA was going to do next week. Anyone?
Nope.
No.
That's all right.
I mean, they can't. Jesus, imagine if they did. Christ.
It would be quite a thing just to have a couple of days, and then Gladys would really cop it, wouldn't she? And our Premier, I think that she's done a great job, but she seems to be getting a little bit of flack now for all the heat that she's given the other states, and then for that to affect monetary policy at a federal, at a national level, would probably be just a little bit too much to even envisage. So there is that. Now, the markets on this one. Colgo, I don't know if you wanted to shove anything in there, but I'm just about to do a quick subject change.
Well, I suppose I'm just going to reach for something that's kind of close to home at the moment, because I'm reading again at the moment Richard Thaler's Misbehaving. For anybody who hasn't read it, you should. It's brilliant. Thaler is the Nobel Prize winning economist who basically is the father of behavioral economics. He's a very funny writer, very interesting, and he did all this work that started out working with Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, the guys who were behind prospect theory. And Kahneman, as you all know, is like the psychologist who does, you know, thinking fast and slow, and he has a new book out called Noise. But Thaler is so much fun because his whole thing is like talking about how inadequate economic models are, and the whole thing about markets not being efficient, and how people behave wildly. People's observed behavior
in day-to-day life is wildly out of step with economic models. And his whole proposition is, and the foundation of his life's work is, well, look, economists say we should behave like this, but everywhere I look, nobody actually behaves like that.
Yeah, she does that.
So how do we explain it? And so the whole thing of, at the moment, in terms of trying to predict people's behavior and then the future path of growth as a consequence of that. To your point, Ken, as I heard you talking about, you know, the 30 years and 10 years, nobody knows what things are going to look like in 10 or 30 years from now. Right? Like, come on, you know, the way things have shaken out in so many areas, when you look at industry, in the industry mix, the increasing threat of regulation by the Biden administration against the world's biggest companies that are such huge weight in the indexes that they're in. You know, nobody knows how that's going to play out. There's so much golf to play on it, I suppose, if you like. There is a lot of movement around China and its position in the world, if you like, its trade relationships, its diplomatic relationships, you know, so and then there's this whole question of what the central banks are going to do. Now, the whole thing about the Fed, I think the simplest way to think about the Fed for me anyway, you know, for a person of little brain, is basically that they're not simply dovish all the time now. So dovishness is not the default setting anymore for the Fed. It's come off, right? So they may be moving towards just towards something that is a little bit more hawkish, and that changes the picture. Changes the picture for the US dollar, changes the picture for the Aussie dollar. I thought the move in the Aussie dollar after the Fed last time was particularly spectacular. I think it wiped a few cents off it, actually. It's regained it all, right? I think where markets are now, obviously, looks sensible, that, you know, there's going to be kind of steady kind of level of inflation, but low over the next little while. And we are in for a spurt of growth in the next few years, which will probably lead to some rate hikes, hence what we're seeing at the short end of the curve.
We will get to where the actual trades can occur at straight after this. Open Trader, for professional traders and those who want to invest like a pro, from only $5 a trade, Open Trader. Let us know if you want to know more about Open Trader. Happy to help you out with that one. But thanks to our sponsors on that one. Now, you were talking about the trade. Now I've got a stat for your boyos. Here we go. Now, the NASDAQ on Friday hit another all-time high. Nothing too amazing, nothing too surprising. But it's only occasional that the NASDAQ hits a 52-week high. It's a 52-week high. When the NASDAQ hits a 52-week high, thank you to Sentiment Trader Twitter account, and those guys do some great work. So the NASDAQ hits the 52-week high when less than 50% of its members are above their 50-day moving average and less than 55% of its members are above its 200-day moving average. Now, we all know that the old expression about the 200-day, nothing good happens underneath your 200-day moving average. So to have about half of your constituents of an index which has hit a year high, that half of those constituents aren't actually really, you know, pulling their weight and being up above the 200 day.
And is this because the big boppers are at all time highs?
It's being dragged up by the big end of town. Like it's your obvious sort of villains that are in that one, and they are some good ones. But when you've had a situation like that before, over the last 20 years, it's only happened about 6 times. So it's happened this time. It happened on Friday. It happened early last year, so just before that 30% drop that we saw. It happened once in 2017. It was a 13% drop in 2015 when it happened, and an 8% drop in the NASDAQ when that happened in 2014. It's just a lack of breadth that you see across the market, and it means that if a couple of those generals, it's when the generals stop marching is the expression. When a couple of those generals decide to stop marching, or something happens, or who knows what it could be, but they just maxed out and they're just done with the buying. There's not a lot of support that's at the other side of the market to really keep the rest of the index up. That could happen. Now, by the time this podcast gets out, we're still going to be looking down the barrel of the end of financial year. The window dressing and all the plumping may just be done. So if the NASDAQ just wanted to take a bit of a break, could be in the first week of the new financial year. I'm just saying that it might just be worth moving your stops up on that one and maybe having a little bit that's off there. But this, I do believe, might be just more of the sort of mood that we should be looking into in the mid-cycle sector. Ken, you got anything just to throw it at you? Anything cooking at the moment with regards to what stage of the cycle that we're in? And how you see this reopening trade going? What if you've got any ways to sort of spice up the portfolios, mate?
Mate, well, how can I put it? Look, for all intents and purposes, I'm basically semi-retired, and equities have never really been my bag. But it's funny, I was having a chat to someone sort of tail end of last week, and sort of brought to mind the fact that very often, on financial TV and wherever else, you hear the question, so what are the implications for stocks, or what does this mean for the indices and this, that, and the other? Honestly, I think that question has been redundant for probably the better part of 4 or more years. I mean, in the short, very short term, yeah, you might have the occasional blip down, and obviously we saw what happened, when COVID really hit the fan March, April of last year and whatnot. But net, in the environment that we face and find ourselves in over the course of the last, well, certainly near on decade, you're hard-pressed to really think that equities are going to do much else than go up. And I know that's very, very blasé and it's a throwaway line, but realistically, when you've got no other viable mattress in town to park your cash under, and if you are genuinely looking at it over the, not even medium, but certainly longer-term horizon, then... Just whack it in stocks, where you're not really going to go that poorly. It's just a case of, be selective and probably just play it at the index level and, you'll be all right type thing. I think what's interesting to me is, as is the case every single year, the consensus trade going into the year, certainly on the FX side, was, well, the dollar, the greenback, the US dollar is going to fall entirely out of bed. It's going to, hit new lows, and it's just going to keep going. And, there's only one way, and that's south for the greenback. And sure enough, there was an element of that probably, Jan, Feb this year, although it probably leveled out mid to late Feb. And since then, all the Dixie, the dollar index has done is trade a range. And yet people are still out there sort of losing their minds over the fact that, oh, my God, the dollar's weaker, or oh my God, the dollar's stronger. What does this mean? What is that? That's about it. I mean, my perception is, I think we're having a bit of a rebound from the dollar strength post FOMC at the moment, so a bit of give back. But net, I don't think that keeps going too much further. And then we settle into a range over the next probably 4 to 6 weeks over the summer. Barring any sort of cataclysmic black, grey, white swans, whatever you want to call it. Mm. And we sort of bump along. Do I have any hard and fast views on trades? No, not really.
Colgo, mate, the area that you'll be able to help us out with is in this reopening trade. Do you still see that China and the US and, to a smaller extent that at home, do you see that those reopening trades are still on track and can still sort of take us in the direction, or do you think it's going to be a bit more clumpier and a bit choppier?
I think I'm not a forecaster, not a trader, but I do think definitely we're looking at a ongoing period of very cheap money for a long time, right? So
yeah, keep to the yep.
And I do think one thing that has changed has been how governments think about fiscal levers. So central banks, for the last 6 years or so, have been just banging on about how fiscal needed to come to the party. They were exhausted in terms of stimulus options,
and governments have now, you know, after the period of austerity, do you remember after the GFC, like austerity was this this whole approach that governments around the world were taking to mending their finances. Now, granted, rates are a little bit lower than they were then, but they weren't like materially higher post GFC. Like they were like a couple hundred basis points or something. But I suppose that feels like, a couple of hundred basis points from here, if you added it on, would blow up the economy, the global economy pretty quickly.
Yeah.
But where we are, I mean, I'm just looking at corporate debt, like even mid-rated corporate bonds are still trading at like 3.5%, you know. So 3.5%. So look, debt is really, really cheap. So there's two things going on. Money is cheap to get, and governments are able to come in, I think, and are smarter, and have learned a lot about how to step in and put a floor under what might look like an economic meltdown, not a market meltdown, but an economic meltdown. And I think that is a very, very welcome thing. But I do think one thing that, you know, while the fiscal stuff is different, the other thing that's different about this recession has been that, you remember before this downturn, there was a lot of talk globally about zombie companies.
Yep.
Companies that shouldn't exist, that had managed to kind of stay afloat because of cheap money. Normally in a recession would take those players out, right? So, you know, you'd have your creative destruction at work and bad or underperforming or unprofitable companies would go under and they would make way for new entrants, right? Where you get your job growth and, confidence and all of that kind of stuff. I don't want to, by any stretch of the imagination, downplay the fact that a lot of companies did go bust last year, and of course a lot of people were out of work. But we haven't had massive bankruptcies. We haven't had banks coming out saying we have these really bad debts on our books now, and these big chunky liabilities from these companies that are in a very bad place. They, you know, putting huge provisions on the books. That hasn't happened this time around. So that for me creates a sort of interesting question of, is it that companies are adapting and finding new ways to do business and survive? Or is it just that this world we're in where it's easy to get funding, easy to borrow to keep going through the next quarter, all of that kind of thing, is helping companies, is leading to companies just behaving differently and getting time and runway to be able to evolve their business model so that they can start making money properly again.
I can answer that for you, Colgo, if I may. It's to my mind, it's definitely the latter. And it's not just the easy money environment. It's actually, it's the first derivative of the fact that it's easy money, because you've got junk debt being so popular that it's practically not even junk debt anymore. And so what we saw pre-GFC in the mass financialization of the various instruments and the ingenuity that went into CDOs and CLS and CD something else squared and cubed, you've got an element of that happening, but not even to the same degree now, because everyone's you know, and has been for the last decade or more, even in the aftermath of the GFC, when rates were, you know, a couple of years later, were probably a couple of hundred basis points higher than they are now. I mean, traditionally, they're still incredibly low rates, right? So if you're looking for yield, you want some bang for your buck. And so this mass, shift in terms of trying to financialize everything and ingenuity and all of that leads to these products. So these companies are always going to be able to lend, or rather borrow money, at what has traditionally, or even by current standards, been incredibly cheap. So I don't think, and there isn't necessarily an even a push for them to finally evolve, you know, so to you know, plaster over their cash flow woes until such time as their business model can evolve. I think for a lot of them, to be honest, there's no motivation to evolve the business model. So either they eventually, whenever the hell that is, do go bust, or they just putt it along and still make a bit of money because, well, you know, cost of financing is so low. So why bother evolving? Because no one's got a gun to their head.
That's I believe will be part of the finding out that happens. I think it's about 300 or 400 companies that are in Russell, because it's going to be the smaller that are in the Russell 1000 index that are at that zombie level of only making enough to be able to pay what interest they do have. So any change in that is going to make it sort of choppier. Which brings me to the point that I just wanted to have, and I'll give you guys the last one. But this is the last thing that I really wanted to say today, just on where I see the next move going into quality from being a part of that value trade and a part of that recovery trade and the rebuilding trade. And as we move into this next cycle, the FT did run a beautiful little article, and it was on the Longview, which is always fantastic to read. But they had just the quote at the back: the CIO of the US fundamental active equity at BlackRock was interviewed. And it was really just a beautiful little comment that he had here. BlackRock's benchmark of high-quality companies is currently trading at its largest discount to the Russell 1000 index in more than two decades. We're still very value-tilted, but we're starting to dial it back and look at the quality trade. So while he expects that value and cyclical shares have not fully exhausted their run, the clock is ticking. Once the economy shifts into a mid-cycle phase, history shows the quality shares start outperforming. Dispirito, that's him, argues a more normal pace of economic growth should prompt a more cautious approach from investors as the risks around taxes, inflation, and the timing of a Fed policy shift become clearer. As a long-term investor, owning quality will pay off. So that I end quote. I think that the move from just being generic and in an index and in the recovery and being okay with those companies now has to start being rotated off, and it's time to make sure that you've got those companies that have got a high return on equity, earning stability, and low financial leverage as being the three generally accepted definitions of quality, and make sure that those are the ways that your portfolios tilt in that direction. That being said, gentlemen, last words, and then we'll thank the sponsors and thank the ball boys and wrap it up.
Yeah, can we just talk about the guys down the south coast with the deer?
Yeah, go for it, mate. Ken, if Ken hasn't heard this, I want to hear Ken hear this for the first time. So, Colgo, can you just bring it up?
This would have happened while you were sleeping, Ken.
Oh, please.
So at the Daily media conference featuring the state premier, Gladys Berejiklian, and then the chief health officer, and then the police commissioner.
And set the scene, the stage, and it's also got the Auslan interpreter as well, Ken. You know, yeah, the way they do the daily press conferences, right?
Yeah. So they've got the Auslan interpreter, and then the police commissioner gets up and told it very concisely. I have to hand it to him. You're telling it more concisely than I am now. But
the best straight man in the industry, right?
He gets up and he says, unbelievably, we had two individuals who, I'm just going to say to my own, these two guys, say in my own language, sorry, these two guys were on the beach. They say they were sunbaking naked, right? And they said,
not that there's anything wrong with that.
This is what the cop said. They claim to have been startled by a deer. And they subsequently ran into a forest where they had to call the SES to get rescued because they get lost, and they were spoken to by police who decided that they didn't have a reasonable excuse for being out of the house and were fined $1,000. But it's just, I'm like, come on, there's more to this story. These guys were found naked in a forest after getting lost. One of them was partially clothed, apparently, but it's like, yeah. So you were in, you're naked in the forest. Why? We were sunbaking on the beach, and deer chased us
in the middle of winter.
but all I want to know is: has anyone quoted the deer in this? Has anyone had a chat to the deer, or caught up with what it thought was going on?
I would like to know.
We all learned a great deal of Auslan, seeing the interpreter do an amazing job of straight facing this incredible story go through.
Yeah, we all know what. The we all know the Auslan for startled.
Startled.
And deer. And what was the other one? Nudist or naked. Yeah, yeah. So we all know the Auslan for that now. Thank you to those. Aren't those Auslan guys great? That's a very, very tough job sometimes, and very essential service, and awesome to see them.
For a time with the bushfires and going into the pandemic, I thought this, you know, the Auslan interpreter shortage was going to be a real thing. So, but they have done an incredible job with some nonsensical things that have been tried to be explained to people that people really can't understand what's going on at the best of times, and you've got to try and decipher that. So, Ken, anything to add, mate?
No, just wishing all of you guys down there good luck, and hopefully they sort things out. I think one thing we didn't mention was, and it doesn't seem to, from what I've seen, get much press, but what's going on in the Northern Territory with the miners up there? I think when we speak next for the next show or whenever it may be, I think we need to touch on that.
Because, you mean the COVID cases?
Yeah.
So what happened was, a guy flew from Victoria to Brisbane before his mine. He went out for his fly-in trip to the mine. And he stayed in a quarantine hotel because there was rules in Queensland about coming up from Victoria. He caught COVID in the quarantine hotel from an international traveler who was on the same floor. Went out to the mine where he worked with 900 other people who they're frantically trying to contact now. He definitely gave it to a couple of other people. But there's about 16, I think last I heard, there's about 16 people that they can't find. Now, just thinking about this, the crews who are out there working in the mines, and they get back to Darwin or Perth or wherever they go back to, and they're uncontactable. Like, there's plenty of reasons why you'd be uncontactable for a few days after working in a mine.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, let's hope they get hold of them, and that there's no rogue cases running around out there.
So hopefully that sort of gets itself sorted out, as well as all the other bits and pieces going on in New South Wales and elsewhere. So, but no, that's probably it from me at the moment. Just heading headlong into summer over here.
Oh, fantastic! That is good to know, Ken. Well. That being the show, Open Trader, for professional traders and those who want to invest like a pro, from only $5 a trade. Let us know if you need to know anything about Open Trader. Fantastic little platform, and thank you very much to them as well for helping us out. Always thankful for the sponsors too. Don't forget to subscribe to the show, rate us, and leave the review wherever you get your podcasts. Five star, please. You can find us on iTunes at The Bip Show. We're on Twitter for some reason. It's @the_bip_show. And we're on Facebook too. Search for The Bip Show. Myself, as I mentioned, I've got a website that we're just putting more bits and pieces onto it, all the little extras and goodies that we can't get onto in the show, including, and I'm doing a new thing, which has been quite popular, calling it The Trade That Paid, because I just like rhyming stuff. And it's where any folks just might want to go and have a look and see any trades. And if he lets you talk to him @KenVexler, don't forget to hit subscribe and rate the show 5 stars, like I said. The show is produced by Rick Salter. G'day, Rick, and we will catch you next time. Thank you, Paul.
Thanks, James.
Thank you, Ken.
Thank you, lads. Been a pleasure.
Thanks for everyone. Thanks for listening.